2 days later, Zaras came to me and asked permission to speak. "Since when do you have to ask my permission? Lack of it has never held you back before," he looked embarrassed. "Princess Tahuti wants me to teach her the manual of arms and to instruct her in the use of the sword. I told her that I would need to have your permission to do this." "That was probably not wise, Zaras. What Her Royal Highness wants, Her Royal Highness usually gets." "I meant no disrespect," he hurried to assure me, and I laughed at his distress. "The princess is an excellent archer," I pointed out. "She is very quick. She has sharp eyes and good strong arms. So I have little doubt that she will make a good sword fighter. It is a skill that could stand her in good stead at some time in the future. Who knows? It might even save her life one day." I'm not sure why I said that. In the event, it turned out to be one of the great understatements of my life. "Do you have any objection to doing as she requests of you, Zaras?" "Not the least objection, my lord," Zaras assured me hurriedly. "On the contrary, I would consider it to be a great honour and privilege."
"Then get on with it. I will be very interested to see what you can make of her."
I thought no more of it, which statement is not the literal truth. I thought of very little else. I agonized a great deal over Zaras and Tahuti in the weeks that followed. Zaras grew stronger every day. If he was hard on his men, he was utterly ruthless with himself. From sunrise each morning until noon, he led his men on a foot race over the roughest terrain. I ran with them. I have been blessed with extraordinary strength and powers of endurance, and I am able to match men half my age or even younger. In the beginning, I could see how Zaras suffered, and was impressed with how he was able to conceal his distress from everybody but me. But within days, he was matching me stride for stride, leading his men in the battalion's marching song and laughing freely at my jokes and sallies. I approved his industry and his constant search for self-improvement. On the other hand, there is a limit to all things. Behaviour that is acceptable in the common people is not always suitable to the dignity of the upper strata of our society. When, without consulting me, Zaras decided that on the future morning runs every man must carry a bag of sand equal to a quarter of their own body weight, I realized that I had been neglecting other, more important duties. Instead of mindlessly charging through the desert, trying to compete with a gang of young hooligans, I had to tutor my princesses in the sciences of mathematics and astrology, and I had to write the final chapters of my treatise on the genealogy of the gods. As far as I am concerned, mind must always take precedence over muscle. While we lingered at Maya Cave, to allow Lord Remrem and his party to precede us to Zainab Oasis, I had time to read and plan ahead for our arrival in Babylon. Time passed pleasantly, if not swiftly. For others in our company there were more spectacular and explosive events. Chief amongst these was the termination of the friendship between Beketha and Colonel Hui. At Beketha's insistence, Hui was giving her riding lessons each evening. Under his tutelage, she was fast becoming an intrepid equestrian. She had always been fearless, and her balance and her seat in the saddle surpassed that of most of Hui's troopers. These fine gentlemen had always been charioteers by nature, and most of them preferred to be behind a horse rather than on top of it. On the other hand, Beketha loved to ride high and handsome as I had taught her. She was always able to get the very best out of her mount. She loved to show off her skills, and she always performed at her best when she had an audience. One evening, we was coaching her in the game of spheres. The sphere was a large and weighty ball composed of strips of woven rawhide. The opposing teams were made up of four riders each, and the object was to carry the sphere between two upright stakes at the end of a marked ground, while the opposing team endeavoured to prevent that from happening. It was a rough and raucous contest, usually watched and cheered on by a large crowd. This particular evening, we was making Beketha practice leaning out from the saddle to pick up a sphere which was rolling and bouncing over the sandy ground ahead of her horse. As usual, there was an audience of some 50 off-duty guardsmen and other loafers lining the field to watch the sport. Beckatha came down the field at full gallop. She had both hands free of the reins and was guiding her mount with her knees. We were standing on the sideline, holding the sphere and waiting for her. As she came up, he threw the sphere out ahead of her. She leaned from the saddle to make the pickup. All her weight was on her near-side stirrup. In my informed and critical judgment, I thought it was a most elegant and athletic performance. The crowd roared their encouragement, and I joined in with them. Beckatha seemed almost elfin on the back of the enormous animal, but still she was able to reach down far enough to grasp one of the four leather handles of the rolling sphere. Triumphantly, she began to lift her prize. Then her stirrup leather snapped, and to my consternation, Beckatha sailed clear of the saddle. I began to run before she hit the ground. I was sure she was killed, or at least seriously injured. Hui was just as quick, and he was closer to her than I was, as she was unhorsed. To my delighted relief, Beckatha bounded to her feet again and stood there, quivering with mortification and rage. She had landed in a mound of fresh horse manure. This had broken her fall and probably saved her life, but it had done little for her appearance and nothing at all for her dignity. She was besmeared from the top of her fiery curls downwards with loose green dung. Hui came up short before he reached her, and he stood staring at her. I could see that he had not the faintest idea what he should do next. Before I could reach him to mollify Beckatha and resolve the crisis, Hui did the one thing most certain to escalate it. He laughed. Beckatha responded in the only way that was natural to her. She slipped the leash on her famous temper. She was still clutching the sphere in her right hand. She hurled it at his head. Hui was not expecting to be attacked, and he was taken off guard. The range was point blank, the sphere was heavy, and the sun-dried leather was hard as bone. It hit him on the bridge of his prominent nose, and the blood spurted in a jet. Even that was insufficient to appease Beckatha's wounded pride. She stooped, and in one swift movement gathered up a double handful of horse dung from the pile in which she was standing. Then she charged straight at Hui and slapped both handfuls onto his injured nose. "If you think that I am funny, you should see yourself now, Colonel Hui," she told him in cold fury. Then she spun around and marched from the field, heading for the royal compound. No one else in the crowd of spectators dared to laugh, not even I. Hui was never again invited to dine at the royal table. He never again enjoyed the distinction of being bombarded with foodstuffs or of giving riding lessons to royalty. A few days later, I overheard a conversation between Beckatha and Loxias. It was in Minoan, and they were in the tent in the royal compound, which I had set aside as the girls' classroom. I was standing outside the back of the tent, admiring the view of the multicoloured cliffs above the encampment. Of course, I was not deliberately eavesdropping on my pupils, but sometimes when I paused briefly at this particular spot before entering the tent, I did inadvertently overhear interesting exchanges between them. "Have you forgiven Colonel Hui yet?" I heard Loxias ask, and Beckatha answered vehemently, "I shall never forgive him. He is an oaf and a barbarian. When I am Queen of Crete, I shall probably have him beheaded." "That would be amusing. Will you invite me to watch?" "I was not jesting, Loxias. I really mean it. But you told me in Tahuti that he was the only man in the world for you." "I've changed my mind." Beckatha's tone was lofty. "What would I want with an ugly old man with no manners and 40 wives just as ugly as he is?" "He isn't so old, Beckatha. And he is rather handsome. I know for a fact that he has only 5 wives in Thebes, and some of them are quite pretty." "He is ancient," Beckatha replied firmly. "He is probably even older than Taita. And he does not strike me as rather handsome with a broken nose and horseshit all over his face. His 5 wives can have him. I don't want anything more to do with him ever again." I excused Beckether's robust choice of words and her derogatory reference to my age. At least one of my immediate problems had been resolved for me. It was no longer necessary for me to stand guard over Beckether's virginity, in addition to that of her big sister. I allowed myself to be overtaken with a fit of coughing, and the voices within the tent stilled. When I stooped in through the opening, the two young ladies' heads were bowed over their writing tablets. They were both most laudably absorbed in the task that I had set them of copying a scroll of Egyptian history from the authoritative version which I had written myself some years previously, and translating it into the Cretan language. Beckether barely glanced up at me when I paused beside her. "I am very impressed with your industry and the perfection of your hieroglyphics, Your Highness. But why is your sister not with you?" "Oh, she's too busy out there," she pointed with her brush. "She told me that she would come to join us later." Then she returned her full attention to the scroll she was working on. I had been aware of the chanting of the guardsmen coming from the improvised drill ground on the edge of our encampment, but this was so commonplace that I had paid no mind to it. Now that Beckether had piqued my curiosity, I left the tent and went out to investigate. There was a swarm of grooms, entertainers, servants, slaves, and other non-combatants lining the drill ground. They were so absorbed that I had to prod them with my staff before they opened the way for me to pass through. I reached the edge of the drill ground, and I stood there, and looked around for Tehuti, but I could not immediately spot her. Zaras was standing facing the ranks of his men. They were all wearing half-armour. However, the visors of their helmets were raised to reveal their faces. They stood to attention, holding their drawn swords at the salute, the naked blades touching their lips. "Passage of arms!" Zaras ordered at a bellow. "The 12 advancing cuts and lunges! One! One!" chanted his men, and in perfect unison they lunged low left and then recovered. The blades glittered like gold in the low sunlight. Then, suddenly, my eyes alighted on a smaller figure in the centre of the leading rank. For a moment I doubted what I was seeing. Then I realised that I was not mistaken, and that it was indeed Tehuti. She wore a perfectly fitting guard's uniform. At least three of her Nubian handmaidens were expert needlewomen, who could have sewn that together in an evening. Any one of the regimental blacksmiths might have altered the half-armour to fit her slender form. She was brandishing a heavy regulation sword that had been forged for a man half again her size. Her face was flushed. Her hair was sodden with sweat, as was her tunic. I was appalled. She looked like a peasant girl who had spent the day scything corn or hoeing her husband's fields. She was surrounded by a gang of rough soldiers, and she was behaving as though she felt no shame for her appearance or respect for her rank and exalted station. Of course I had agreed to her receiving lessons in swordplay from Zaras. I admit that I had even encouraged the plan. However, I had taken it for granted that those lessons would have taken place in private and well screened from the common horde. The good gods will readily attest that I am no snob, but there should be limits to royal condescension. My first impulse was to rush out onto the drill ground, seize Tehuti by the scruff of her neck, drag her back into the privacy of the royal compound, and insist in the strongest terms that in future she was more suitably attired and that her behaviour was more seemly when she was under public scrutiny. Then my good sense prevailed. I knew that she would not hesitate to defy me in front of an entire regiment, and to dilute the respect and awe in which they hold me. While I dithered, the opportunity passed me by. I watched her glide through the passage of arms with such consummate skill and grace that she made the hard warriors who surrounded her seem to be lumbering ploughmen. She never missed a step nor lost the rhythm. Smoothly, she switched her sword from hand to hand, lunging and cutting as swiftly and accurately with the left as with the right. Her face was a mask of concentration and determination. Her performance was a thing of high skill and great beauty, and there was no mistaking the power in the slender arms that wielded the heavy blade. She made it whisper and sing a song of deadly menace as she moved through the exercises. At the end, she stopped as still as an ivory statue, balancing in full extension and holding her sword as though it were made of gossamer, not heavy metal. "Stand easy," Zaras ordered. The spectators burst into a chorus of applause, clapping and stamping their feet. Then a single voice called her name, drawing it out into three distinct syllables. "Te-hu-ti!" Immediately the chant was taken up by the others. "Te-hu-ti!" Their adulation was contagious. I was filled with pride and love for my little protege. I found myself caught up in the fervour of hero worship. "Te-hu-ti!" My own dignity was forgotten as I joined in the chanting chorus. At last a camel rider arrived at Maya Cave from the north. He carried a message from Lord Remrem, informing me that his advance company was about to march from the oasis at Zainab, where they had been recuperating for the last 2 weeks. Remrem assured me that all was well. He had lost no men and only one camel, which had broken its leg in a fight with another bull. He had been forced to slaughter the beast and feed the meat as rations to his men. He urged me to come on to Zainab at my best speed, where I would find the oasis deserted and the surface water fully replenished from its subterranean spring. I passed the order to Zaras, but it took another 2 days to break camp and load the pack animals. During that time, I summoned Zaras to my quarters and made him strip to enable me to check the healing of his injuries. I found him to be in magnificent physical condition. His surgical scars were difficult to detect, particularly in view of the fact that his dark body hair had grown out profusely to cover them. He assured me that despite the internal laceration inflicted upon it, his bowel function was as efficient as it had ever been, and I did not feel that it was necessary to require a demonstration of this claim from him. That very morning, I had seen him returning at the front of a 10-league foot race, in full armour and with a large sack of sand balanced on one shoulder. Our company marched from Maya Cave in the late afternoon, when the sun had lost its virulent heat. We continued through the night, with the waxing moon to light our way. We went into camp again with the rise of the hot new sun, and almost 20 leagues behind us. I was well pleased. I walked through the new encampment to make certain that all was in good order before I took my own rest. It always surprises me how a few kind words from me are treasured by even the lowliest members of our entourage. One often forgets how one is revered by others, less talented than oneself. However, on this occasion my equanimity was shattered by the uproar that greeted me when I returned to the royal compound. In fact, I became aware of it while I was still some distance away. The weeping, the wails of despair, the cries of bitter remonstrations, all carried clearly on the desert air. I broke into a run, convinced that tragedy and death had struck in our midst. When I entered the compound, I found that the royal handmaidens and servants were almost witless with terror. They were unable to respond to my urgent questions. I became so impatient with their stupidity that I seized one of the Nubian handmaidens by the shoulders and tried to shake some sense into her. This proved to be unwise. The simple uproar surrounding me became total bedlam. Hurriedly, I released the little lass and reassured her that I was not going to chastise her, and then I headed for the central tent which belonged to Tehuti. When I entered, I had to push my way through the throng of loudly lamenting femininity to reach my princess, who was lying on her cot. She was on her stomach, with her face buried in her arms. Her entire body was racked with sobs. As soon as she heard my voice, she jumped off the cot and threw herself into my arms. "What is it, my little one? Has somebody died? What terrible tragedy has overtaken you?" "My ring. I have lost my ring, and I am certain that somebody has stolen it." "What ring?" For a moment I was mystified. She held up her left hand with all her fingers extended stiffly. "My ring is gone, the ring you gave me, the magical diamond ring that you brought me from the fortress at Tamiat."
"Calm yourself. We will find it for you." I was relieved at the mild nature of the calamity.
"But what if you can't find it? It's the one thing I love most in the entire world. I will kill myself if it is lost."
"Firstly, get all these women out of here, and then we can talk about it calmly and sensibly. I used my staff and my most persuasive language to drive the cackling women from the tent. Then I returned to sit beside Tehuti on the cot and take her hand. Now, tell me where and when you last saw it." I invited her. She pondered my question, and as I watched her face, I realized that, despite all the sobbing and lamentation and threats of suicide, her lovely eyes were devoid of tears. In fact, now that we were alone, she appeared to be quite relaxed, even enjoying herself. My suspicions were immediately aroused.
"Ah, yes, I have it." Her face lit up with theatrical relief. "I remember now. I know where I must have lost it. Just before we left Maya Cave yesterday afternoon, Loxias, Becatha, and I went for a last swim in the water cavern. I remember that I took the ring off my finger before I entered the water, and I placed it in the same crack in the rock that I always do, so that I would not lose it. I must have left it there."
"Are you certain? You could not have dropped it elsewhere?" I asked, seriously, going along with her fibs and fantasies.
"Yes, I'm certain, and no, I could not have dropped it elsewhere," she assured me, just as earnestly.
"Well, that makes it very easy," I smiled at her. "Your worries are over, Tehuti. I shall send Colonel Hui back to Maya Cave to find it for you. On his fastest horse he should get there and back before tomorrow morning."
But she was taken aback.
She wrung her hands with distress.
"No, I don't want you to send Hui."
"Why not?" I asked innocently. "Hui is a good man."
"I think,"
she paused as she tried to find a convincing reason, "I gave her time to come up with her next invention.
It will be difficult to describe to Hui exactly where I left it. Hui is a foreigner. His Egyptian isn't very good."
I watched her steadily, and she could not meet my eyes. "He may have a foreign accent, but his Egyptian is good enough to command a regiment." I refuted her excuse, but she rallied gamely.
"I don't trust Hui. You know how he humiliated our poor little Becatha. He will probably steal the ring. I wouldn't put anything past him."
"In that case, perhaps you should rather go back to the cavern to find it yourself."
"I hadn't thought of that," she exclaimed enthusiastically, having steered me to the conclusion she wished for all along. "But you're right, Taita. I will have to go myself."
"But you cannot go alone. I will have to send somebody with you. Not we, of course, because you do not trust foreigners."
I pretended to think it over.
"I would have sent Lord Remrem, but of course he is not here. At any other time I would ride with you, but my back is sore, and I must rest it." I placed both hands in the small of my back and gave a soft grunt of pain.
"My poor Taita, I would never allow you to take the chance of injuring yourself further."
She watched my face anxiously. "I have it," I exclaimed. "I shall have to send Captain Zaras with you." She dropped her eyes. She realized that I had been teasing her, and she had the grace to be abashed. She looked up at me, and she saw my expression was benign. She gave up her play-acting and giggled endearingly. Then she threw her arms around my neck and hugged me so hard that it hurt.
"I love you," she whispered. "I really and truly do."
I returned her hug and whispered back, "It might be more discreet if you leave that naughty old ring with me, just in case it does truly jump from your finger." She reached into her sleeve. When she brought out her hand, it was closed into a fist. She held it tantalizingly in front of my face.
"I would trust you with anything else that I have, except this. She opened her hand, and the famous diamond ring lay in her palm. When I return, it shall be on my finger, and I shall never remove it again. It will always be the symbol of my love for Zaras. Even if my duty forces me to relinquish him forever, this ring will remain with me to remind me of him. She and Zaras left within the hour. They pressed their mounts so urgently towards the south that their bodyguard had fallen back half a league behind them as they disappeared over a distant dune. I felt only a little guilty at this flagrant dereliction of my duty. However, my guilt was overshadowed by my elation that I felt at having been able to grant this fleeting interlude of happiness to two young people so very dear to me. I had not expected the two of them to hurry back from Maya Cave to rejoin the caravan. They did not disappoint me. We waited at Zainab Oasis for almost a week before the two of them finally reappeared. As they dismounted outside my command tent, Tahuti whispered to Zaras, "Wait here, I must speak to him alone." They were in bright sunlight, so they did not see me watching them from the shadows of the tent. I was able to read Tehuti's lips without her being aware of it. She ran to the opening of my tent. As I came to meet her, she let out a soft cry of joy, and she rushed into my open arms. While we embraced, I realized that in the short time since I had last seen her, she had been transmuted miraculously from childhood to full womanhood, from dross to royal gold. "Did you find what you went to seek?" I asked, without releasing her. "Oh, yes, I did." She held up her hand in front of me. The diamond sparkled at me, but not as brightly as her eyes. "I love this, but I love the other treasure that I found in the cavern much more dearly." "I don't think we should discuss that," I interrupted her hastily, and stepped back from her embrace. "I don't want to hear about it."
"But I'm going to tell you everything, every tiny detail, because it is the most wonderful thing that has ever happened to me," she spoke with utter sincerity.
I looked out through the tent opening. Poor Zaras was still standing there, with a hangdog aspect, very much like a small boy who's been caught in the orchard stealing apples and was expecting a beating for it. I let the subject pass without belaboring it further. I was so close in spirit to Tehuti that a little of her ecstatic mood seemed to be transferred to me, and from me to all the others in the company. The encampment became a happy place filled with smiles and laughter. However, I was pleasantly surprised with how discreet Tehuti and Zaras were in perpetuating their romance. I think that I was probably the only one who knew that it was happening. Even Bekatha, who lets very little pass her by, seemed to be unaware. I was content with and even proud of my decision to be the guardian of their love, rather than the impediment to it. I was poignantly reminded how so long ago I had filled the same role for Tahuti's father and mother. Our stay at Zainab Oasis was too short for all of us. We had to move on. Week after week we followed the tracks that Remrem and his party had left across the magnificent wilderness. Like no other place in the world, the desert has a beauty and grandeur that calms the frantic heart and brings us closer to our gods. This was one of the most memorable and satisfying periods of my life. But with each march northwards, we drew closer to Lord Remrem and his column, until finally we caught up with him and joined our forces with his. This was all part of my carefully laid plans, and the reunion took place when we were only 40 leagues south of the Euphrates, although there was no indication that such a mighty river lay so close ahead of us. We were still surrounded by barren, rock-strewn hills and dusty, sun-scorched valleys. Our one-eyed guide, Al-Namju, had brought us to the final oasis before we reached the river. This was a place named Krus. Here there was a cluster of some 15 wells, all of them delivering good, sweet water. This supply supported a populous village and an extensive plantation of date palms and other agriculture.
There was sufficient water available to support even the large numbers of men and animals in our caravan for a short time. No sooner had we encamped than Al-Namju came to me with an even more lugubrious expression than the one that usually decorated his ugly visage. "Revered Lord Taita," he bowed before me. I had learned that since the execution of his treacherous son, such obsequious behaviour usually heralded an outrageous request or some particularly unpleasant and pessimistic announcement. From here, the caravan route to the town of Ur of the Chaldees on the Euphrates River is well travelled and clearly marked. The river is close by. It would not be possible for you to go astray, he told me. In that case, you will have no difficulty in guiding us to Ur, in accordance with our agreement, will you, Al-Namju? Mighty Lord Taita, I beg your understanding and compassion. I dare not enter the town of Ur. It would be more than my wretched life is worth. I have blood enemies there. These Akkadians are vindictive and dangerous people. I pray you to release me and let me return south to Juba, there to mourn my eldest son. He squeezed a tear from his empty eye socket. It was not a pleasing sight to watch. Of course you wish me to pay you the full amount for your hire that we agreed upon, I asked, and he dropped to his knees and plucked tufts of curling hair from his head. You are my father and my master. The choice is yours, but I am a poor man. I have to care for my son Harun's widow and all her offspring. The fates have been unkind to me. I listened to the catalogue of his woes while I considered his request. I could not disregard the fact that he was the father of a treacherous son, and that a son is cast in the same mould as his sire. On the other hand, I had forced him to kill his own son. Did that not pay off the debt? I asked myself. Perhaps he had suffered enough. I am a kind and generous man by nature, but perhaps this is more a fault than a virtue. I shrugged and told him, You have done good work for me, Al-Namju. You may go with my blessing. I opened my purse and took 2 silver mem coins from it. These I dropped into his cupped palms. Then I allowed him to kiss my feet and depart. 4 days later, I stood on the low hills above Ur of the Chaldees and looked down on the town and on the green Euphrates River for the first time. I was chagrined to realize that the river was wider than our mother Nile, which until that time I had never doubted was the greatest river in the world. The Euphrates banks were heavily forested for as far as I was able to see in both directions. Large fields of agriculture had been hewn out of the forest. After the harsh desert landscape through which we had travelled for so long, such an expanse of lush greenery was a delight to my eyes. On the river bank below where I stood sprawled the city of Ur. At its centre was a large ziggurat, a temple dedicated to the goddess Ishtar, the principal deity of the Sumerian and Akkadian people. This one was a pyramid-shaped building with 5 terraces of receding size, banked one on top of the other. Not only was it a temple, but it served as a refuge for the priests and priestesses when the river burst its banks and inundated the city and its surrounding. We started down the road into the city. I rode at the head of our column with Lord Remrem and the princesses, and before we reached the foot of the hills, a procession of priests and priestesses emerged from the main gate in the city wall of dried red mud bricks and came to meet us. Although Babylon was still 120 leagues further upstream, I had not wanted to arrive in the capital city of King Nimrod immediately after completing the desert crossing. I wanted to impress the Sumerians with our wealth and pomp. In our present travel-worn condition, we looked more like desert Bedouin than the representatives of one of the greatest and most prosperous nations on earth. As the procession approached, I recognized Lord Fat-Tur walking at the head of it between the high priest and priestess from the temple. Fat-Tur was the Egyptian ambassador to Sumeria. He and I had known each other since long before he had left Thebes to take up his present post. He was a diligent and reliable official,
so I was confident that the preparations for our arrival in Babylon had been well taken care of. I dismounted to greet him warmly, and then, as we walked together back to the city gates, we chatted together as old friends. "As you requested, Taita, I have chartered 10 large comfortable river barges to carry you, the princesses and the senior members of your delegation, upstream to Babylon, as soon as you are ready to travel. Naturally, I will accompany you. But in the meantime, I respectfully suggest that the greater part of your caravan should travel ahead of you by road to Babylon, to await your arrival there." By the time we had settled into the accommodation that Fat Tor had arranged for us in the great ziggurat, the sun was setting. I left the princesses and their women to unpack all the finery that they had brought with them from Thebes. At last they were able to begin the primping and preening in preparation for their arrival at the court of King Nimrod in Babylon. I had explained to the royal ladies just how important it was that they make a grand showing to impress His Majesty King Nimrod, as well as the Cretan ambassador, who would report it all to his master, the supreme Minos in Crete. I dined that evening with Fat Tor and Remrem. We sat out on the wide terrace of the ziggurat, under the panoply of stars, and indulged our appetites on huge golden river perch as long as my arm, which had been netted that morning in the Euphrates. We washed the luscious pink flesh down with several flagons of pleasant red wine from the vineyards that grew along the river bank. Once we had eaten, we were able to turn our full attention to my grand plan for prosecuting the war against the Hyksos to its ultimate conclusion. As you well know, it is my intention to inveigle both King Nimrod and the Supreme Minos into a military coalition with our beloved Pharaoh. Once we have achieved that, then we will have King Gorab laid out on the anvil with 3 great hammers pounding him into annihilation. As always, your choice of words is captivating but not particularly edifying, my good Taita. I am not entirely clear as to who is the anvil and who are the hammers that you speak of so eloquently, Remrem demurred. I sighed inwardly. Sometimes conversation with Remrem is rather like taking a cripple up the mountain. He has to be helped every step of the way. You must forgive me. I was using a metaphor. I should have made myself clearer. The Sahara is the anvil, and the armies of Crete, Sumeria, and our Egypt are the hammers. Then what you might have said was that we would have Gorab surrounded. Remrem lectured me pedantically. Your reference to hammers and anvils was somewhat confusing. Plain speech is always preferable, don't you think? Indubitably, and I am grateful to you, my lord, for your scholarly advice, I replied, with such restraint that I surprised even myself. However, the point that I was trying to make was that neither Crete nor Sumeria are as committed to the struggle against the Hyksos as we are. With relief, I switched my attention from Remrem to Fat Tor. I would very much like to hear your views on King Nimrod's position. Perhaps you might be able to enlighten us further. Fat Tor inclined his head in acquiescence. I was merely waiting for this opportunity to meet you face to face and to explain matters to you more fully than was ever possible by messages carried on the leg of a pigeon. Of course, you know that Nimrod inherited the crown from his father, King Marduk, who died 14 years ago. Yes, I agreed. I know all that. The last 30 years of Marduk's reign were spent in rebuilding Babylon and transforming it into the most beautiful and splendid city in creation. I had indeed heard that Marduk had undertaken some extensive works. However, I doubt that Babylon can ever match the splendor of Thebes. Then I think you have a surprise in store for you, Fat Tor smiled. It is generally believed that King Marduk spent over 600 lakhs of silver on the project. What is certain is that he stripped the treasury bare in the process of carrying through this obsession of his. I stared at him in amazement. It took me some little time before I could frame my reply. I was led to believe that Sumeria was as rich, if not richer, than Crete. I shook my head, doubtfully.
Yes, that is what most people think. I have been living in Babylon for the last 5 years, and at first I also believed the myth of the great wealth of Sumeria. It is only very recently that I learned the truth. King Nimrod does not have sufficient funds to pay his own ministers. His civil service is in tatters. His army is crippled by lack of weapons and equipment. His troops are deserting in droves because he cannot pay them. He could not possibly mount an offensive against the Hyksos, even though he is fully aware that by not doing so, he places his country in deadly jeopardy. Both Remrem and I stared at him speechlessly. Remrem's expression was stricken. I knew that he was seeing our entire project crumbling to dust. He had been certain that Nimrod of Sumeria would make us a powerful ally. Fat-Tur was busily destroying that hope. On the other hand, I was elated. For me, the way forward was now clear. Nimrod was insolvent. He was losing his army and his country. He must be desperate. I had almost 10 lakhs of silver hidden under the false floorboards of my wagons and in the sandbags of my camels, and hundreds of lakhs more piled up in Pharaoh's treasury in the Valley of the Kings. King Nimrod and Sumeria belonged to us. I would be able to dictate our own price. Nimrod dared not refuse me. I had my first hammer in my hand, despite Remrem's quibbling and nitpicking at my choice of words. My other hammer was waiting for me on the island of Crete. The price for it, in silver, was minimal. But the price in misery and heartbreak might prove extortionate.